Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Empowering Family Caregivers on Blog Talk Radio. I am John Mills, your host and co-founder of eCareDiary.com, a leading online community for family caregivers managing the diverse aspects of elder care. We are a centralized resource providing the targeted content and unique online tools caregivers need to manage care. Thank you for tuning in. I'd like to remind everyone that you can listen to any of our past shows on www.ecarediary.com by clicking our blog tab. We encourage you to register for our free newsletter to learn about our upcoming shows, where we will interview a broad range of medical, healthcare, and elder care experts. I'm very pleased to introduce today's guest, Howard Gluckman. Howard is an expert in long-term care issues, a resident fellow at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C., and the author of the book, Caring for Our Parents. He has experience as a caregiver helping both his father and father-in-law. Howard is also a senior advisor to Caring from a Distance, a nonprofit organization that provides web-based and telephone assistance to long-distance caregivers. He is the co-chair of the Medical Quality Committee at Suburban Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, and is also a member of the hospital's Board of Trustees. A veteran journalist with a career spanning over 20 years, Howard writes a twice-monthly column on long-term care issues for Kaiser Health News and was a 2003 National Magazine Award finalist for a series of Business Week articles entitled The Coming Revolution in Healthcare. Howard, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you, John.
Well, you're such an expert in long-term care and elder care issues, so it's really great to have you and to have your perspective. So I'd like to start by asking you, how is elder care changing today?
Well, John, it's changing actually in a lot of ways, in some very good ways, and then in some that are a little more challenging. The good news, of course, is that we're living longer and we're living healthier. Disability and old age is declining. So this is all great. Technology is making it easier for people to live longer and live with chronic disease. So that's the good news. The bad news is that healthcare is becoming much more fragmented. The divisions between healthcare and personal care and long-term care remain as challenging as they've been in a long time. And then, of course, the other issue is resources. And long-term care is costing more and more. You know that the average cost of a nursing home is $75,000 a year. Assisted living facilities are $30,000 a year. Home health aides are $20 an hour. And we don't have the resources increasingly to pay for all this. Medicaid, which is a government program to pay for it for those who are very sick and very poor, is also facing severe financial constraints. So in that environment, it's going to be very challenging for people to care for their loved ones.
Yeah, it's interesting you speak about the cost. I didn't realize that nursing homes were now $75,000 a year, but I remember when I was caring for my father, you really don't realize how quickly he was living at home and was getting about 8 to 12 hours of home care a day at the end. You don't realize how quickly that adds up.
Oh, it's really true. The conventional wisdom is that it's less expensive to be at home, but it's really not. If you get to the point where you need round-the-clock care, or even 12 hours of care a day, something like that, it can really add up, and it can in some ways be more costly than living in a nursing home. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, it's really true. So with all these changes that are going on, we just passed the health reform law, and while people have really focused on the issues around the uninsured and the exchanges and then a lot of the misinformation that was going around about 18 months ago on it, there's a lot of stuff in there about long-term care and elder care. Can you talk about some of the provisions that are in there that are going to change elder care and long-term care?
Sure. There are three or four very important provisions. And the first one I want to mention is actually throughout the bill, and it's not specifically about elder care. It's about integrating care for people with chronic disease. You know, one of the problems we've had in this country really from, going back to the 1960s when Medicare and Medicaid were created was we drew this very bright line between what was health care, what was acute medical care, and what is personal care or long-term care. And that bright line, if you're you know this from being a caregiver yourself, this is entirely irrelevant to somebody who just needs care. And this, the new health law, one of the important things it does is it begins to break down that separation. And it begins to say that healthcare providers have to begin to think about providing the full range of care, whether it's what we consider medical care or whether it's more personal care for people with chronic disease. That's very important. And it happens in this law through a series of demonstrations and experiments. And there's no real profound change yet, but you can see the beginnings. We're starting to head down a road of if you can call it holistic care for people with chronic disease. It's going to be very important. It's very important for providers, and it's certainly going to be very important for people receiving the care and their family members. The other pieces, changes in Medicaid, some more incentives for states to provide home and community-based care under the Medicaid program, try to get people out of nursing homes and keep them at home. States have been talking a good game about this for years, but have been putting far too few resources into this. The law does provide more federal dollars to encourage states to expand their home and community-based programs. The challenge there is, of course, with the states and the kind of budget difficulties they're all in, it's not clear whether states are going to actually be willing to expand some of these programs. What we're seeing, we just saw it the other day in California, states are actually cutting these programs back. So that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch. Then there's the CLASS Act. The CLASS Act is for the first time, we're going to try to provide national voluntary long-term care insurance for people who want it. This will allow working people to buy a government insurance plan to finance at least part of their long-term care needs. Again, it's very controversial. There are real questions about whether it's properly designed and will, in fact, generate enough interest. But it is an important first step away from the kind of Medicaid-based, welfare-based system that we have today. So there are a lot of interesting changes in there that are certainly worth watching.
I find the CLASS Act fascinating, and I know that you were one of the major movers around it. But one of the things that I think is really interesting about it is the fact that it really lifts some of the restrictions around current private long-term care policies about what you can and can't use the benefit for. And I think it would be great if you go into a little bit of detail for our listeners about the flexibility that the CLASS Act allows you to use the benefit for.
Yeah, I think actually the most important piece of the CLASS Act is that it provides a cash benefit. You would get a benefit, it's not clear how much it'll be, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 or $60 a day, something like that. And you'll be able to use that benefit for essentially anything you want. If you want to use it to pay your niece to take care of you, you can do that. If you want to use it to build a wheelchair ramp, you can do that. If you want to use it for adult day or to pay for assisted living, you can do that. For care management services, that's a whole range of issues. So unlike the current Medicaid system where you're very limited in how you can spend the dollars, or even private long-term care insurance, which does provide some flexibility, but not nearly the kind of flexibility you get with cash, this is a very different model, and it allows people to really design their own care. And I think that's extremely important. There are other provisions of this that I think are also very interesting. It is a lifetime benefit, so you'll get this daily benefit, whatever it's going to turn out to be, for life. Most private long-term care insurance policies are usually limited these days to 3 years or 5 years. So for somebody, for example, with dementia, it's going to provide a kind of a significant a length of benefit, even though the daily benefit is rather modest. The one other thing I'd say about that daily benefit is a lot of people look at it and say, well, $50 a day, what good is that going to do? But in fact, for many people, $50 a day can be 3 or 4 hours of home care. It can pay for a good chunk of an adult day program. So it's not insignificant. It would be nice if it were more, but it's a pretty good start. The question is, what's the premium going to be, and will people be able to afford it, and will they be willing to buy it? One of the things we've seen with private long-term care insurance is this is just not something that people want to think about. Will they be more inclined to buy a policy if it's run by the government than if it's run by private insurance? We're going to just have to see.
Yeah, no, I think that is, I think you've really raised a couple of important points that, you know, people have poo-pooed the $50 a day benefit, but when my father was receiving his long-term care insurance benefit, which was only three, four years ago, I think he was getting about $65 a day. So it's really not that far off the mark from what people get now. And the fact that you have so much more flexibility, which you can use it for, I think that's a really important thing that you're bringing up.
That's right. And the other thing is, you know, keep in mind that, you know, $50 a day doesn't sound like much, but when you add it up, it's $18,000 a year. And that's real money, you know.
It is real money.
Yeah.
It is real. And a lot of people, particularly early on when you're caring for someone, you know, the amount of home care they need, it tends to go up as they get sicker. So I remember for my father, it was 4 hours, and we went to 8 hours, and then to 12 hours. Mm-hmm. But it's not unusual for you early on to be using 4 hours a day. So it could cover a big chunk of that care early on.
That's right. And also, you know, keep in mind the you know, to sort of fall back on the stereotype here, you are the adult daughter of a mother who needs care. You're caring for your own kids and you're trying to hold down a job. Having somebody who can come in for 3 or 4 hours a day can really make the difference for you in your ability, for example, to keep your job. So it's not insignificant. It's definitely worth it. Whether people are going to think it's sufficiently worth it to pay $100 or $125 a month as a premium for this, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting. I have been told, and I haven't seen any empirical data on this, but I have been told that the people who are most likely to purchase current private long-term care policies are people who've been caregivers themselves and have seen either the advantage or disadvantage of having or not having one. So I do think there is a market there for it, but it'll be interesting to see how big it is.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You talked a little bit earlier about care coordination, and that is just, it's a problem across our healthcare system. But I think anyone who's dealt with the long-term care system knows how much worse and how much more fragmented that is than even our sort of general healthcare system. So could you go into a little bit more detail about some of the care coordination demonstrations and provisions that are in the healthcare bill?
Sure. And you're exactly right. This is immensely frustrating for caregivers, and it is frankly dangerous and even deadly for those people who are receiving care. You know, in this world of hyper-specialization, you know, you've got the guy who's caring for your left knee, and you have the doctor who's taking care of your heart disease, and another doctor who's taking care of your arthritis, and somebody else is worried about your diabetes, and they never talk to each other. And then you run into that situation where you're hospitalized, and it's time to be discharged, and no one has any idea what to do. They just kind of send you off. They give you a Xerox page and say, go to this nursing home, and you don't have any idea what's happening to you. The issue with drugs, polypharmacy, or the issue of people taking many, many drugs and the drugs interacting with one another and folks not even knowing what it is they're taking, extremely dangerous. So what the health law says is, let's see if there are ways that we can begin to pull together the various providers in this system so they'll begin to work together and provide you with care that crosses the continuum, that gets you from home to the hospital, from the hospital to the nursing home, from the nursing home back home, in a relatively seamless way. So there are several models out there that they're talking about. One of them is something called the medical home, and the idea there is that your primary care physician would be paid extra money by Medicare to coordinate all of that care, all that specialist care that we were just talking about. Another design they talk about is something called bundle payments, and the idea there is that a group of providers, and it might be a hospital and a nursing home and a home health agency, would all be paid a fixed amount of money, which they then divide among themselves to again provide you with coordinated care through the course of your disease, whether it's an acute care episode or whether it's something that's chronic. So again, to give you the example, you have a stroke, you go to the hospital, then you have to go perhaps to a nursing home for rehab, a skilled nursing facility for rehab for a couple of weeks, and then you go home. In the current system, that's all provided by different organizations. They don't really talk to each other very well. In this new design, if it works the way they hope, what will happen is that there'll be a single organization that will get a fixed amount of money to care for your stroke, and they'll have incentives to make sure that you don't go back to the hospital, that you get the best post-acute care you can. So it's good for you because you can get home and get some physical therapy and the rehab that you need. And it's good for the providers because perhaps they can do this in a way that can make them a little bit of money. So it's a win-win. So the models are called bundle payments. There's a variation of this called accountable care organizations that are a little more formal organizations that would do the same kind of thing. But the basic idea is how can we provide you with care across the continuum? And again, break down this barrier between what is acute care and what is personal care. So I think it's got a lot of potential, but it's an experiment. It's actually a series of experiments. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I hope it's successful. I personally experienced the issue with the medication with my father shortly after he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. They put him on one of the Parkinson's medications. I don't remember what it was now. And every time he'd take it, he'd fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And at first we were just, well, you know, he's getting old and type of thing. Then we realized there was a problem, and we brought all his medications into his primary care physician, who picked up two of them and said, these two are interacting with mm-hmm. the Parkinson's medication, which is why you're falling asleep. But you know, fortunately, it was just falling asleep. You hear stories about people who are rushed to emergency rooms because the doctor prescribes a medication that has a serious interaction with something else they're taking. So, I mean, this really is a patient safety issue, too.
It really is. My dad had congestive heart failure, and when he was sent home from the hospital after his episode, he was taking over a dozen different meds for this. I spent a lot of time on the phone with the doc trying to figure out whether there was some way we could reduce these or sort of make it a little more coherent, easier for him to manage. It was a real challenge. When he eventually went onto hospice, and it was really interesting because the hospice people, and that is a case of coordinating care, the hospice people really were able to get his meds under control. And interestingly enough, he lived a lot longer than the cardiologist ever thought he would under hospice care. And that model, that hospice model of coordinated care, is really the kind of model that people are looking at when they're trying to design coordinated care for people who are chronically ill but not going to die. And that's the kind of paradox in the current system we have is we provide you with a pretty good chronic care system, but only when you're dying through hospice, and we need to do better than that.
Absolutely. It's sad and a little frightening, but I'm really glad that we're trying to take some steps to address that in the health reform law. One of the other things that I thought was interesting in the healthcare reform law is that there are incentives in there to get health professionals to specialize in geriatrics, and mm-hmm. We're going to need that because of the silver tsunami with the baby boomers retiring. And at the same time as the baby boomers are retiring, we're going to face a shortage of senior care medical professionals to care for them. So what exactly is the healthcare reform law going to do around getting people to go into geriatrics?
It's amazing. When I wrote Caring for Our Parents, I had the opportunity, of course, to visit with a lot of families and got to know from their point of view what long-term care was like and how it worked for them. But I also got a chance to talk to a lot of medical experts and other people, and there were some things I learned that completely surprised me. And the thing I think that shocked me the most was when I learned that we have 33 million people over 65 in the United States, and there are 7,000 board-certified geriatricians in the entire country. And I was floored when I heard that. Couldn't believe it was true, but it is. We actually have more geriatricians retiring each year than we have getting certified. Not only have the problem with physicians, we have the problem with nurses, with geriatric specialized nurses. We have it with pharmacists. We have it with psychiatrists. It's just across the board. Nobody or relatively few healthcare professionals want to go into this business. So what the health law does is it does provide some financial incentives for people to choose this as a specialty. I'm not sure that it's going to be sufficient to get young docs to do this or young nurses to do this, but it's absolutely, as you say, it's absolutely critical as the baby boom generation begins to retire. We just absolutely are going to have healthcare professionals who can provide, you know, care with a really strong knowledge base, and right now we don't have that. One of the great disappointments to me in the health law is it does very little to encourage certified nursing assistants. And the CNAs are the backbone, really, of the long-term care system. And, you know, as we all know, they are grossly underpaid. They have poor or no benefits. It would have been nice to see some incentives to encourage people to participate in that occupation. But there's very little, and there's a little bit for training, but there's essentially nothing in there for them, and that's a shame.
That really is a shame, and you're right. They are the backbone of the long-term care system. One of the things I wanted to talk about, we've talked a lot about what we're doing here in the U.S. and what's in the healthcare reform bill, but your book, you talked about how the rest of the world handles long-term care. Can you share your thoughts a little bit on sort of who you see as the models, what works best, what's worse than other models in other countries?
Sure. It's really interesting. You know, just as with healthcare, we are well behind the curve in terms of reforming our long-term care system. Most of the rest of the developed world, including nearly all of Europe, with the exception of the United Kingdom, and much of Asia, have gone to a system of, on financing, a system of government-provided long-term care, which works, you might think of it a little bit like Medicare in this country. Essentially what happens is you pay a payroll tax during the course of your working life, and then when you need the care, it's just there for you. This is the system in Germany and Japan and France and Israel and Spain and South Korea. Really, most developed countries have gone to this kind of a system. You know, these countries have a much more well-developed sense of sort of a social obligation than we do. You know, Americans think of themselves as much more independent. But it's actually working relatively well in most of these countries. There are different designs. In Germany, nearly all the insurance is provided by the government. It's available for everyone. In France, there's a relatively modest government program, which is, actually looks a little bit like class in terms of the size of the benefit. And what's happened there is people are buying private insurance to supplement the basic government insurance. Japan does it a little differently. Japan only has the program available for people who are over 65. People who are younger and disabled don't get the insurance there. So there are lots of different models. You know, some you can imagine could be adapted in the United States. Others it's a little more difficult to see. Where people all face challenges, though, are in delivery. While many of these countries have done a very nice job in figuring out how they're going to finance long-term care, they still struggle with the delivery issues. You know, do they have the workforce to provide the care that people need? Well, really, they don't. In countries like Japan, where there's very strong restrictions on immigration, they really don't have people who are available to do this work. It's actually a funny story in Japan. The reason that Japan created this system was because the Japanese government was under tremendous pressure from women who had traditionally been required to care for not only their own mothers, but their mothers-in-law. And that system was falling apart when, after World War II, women had to go to work. And you had the same kind of issues that we actually have now in the United States, where women were caring for their children, caring for their mothers, and trying to work. And they actually had a name for it over there. They called it caregiver hell. And the Japanese women put tremendous pressure on the government to provide a benefit program, so that, or an insurance program, I should say, so that they could get help, get aides who could provide some assistance. The trouble is that in a country like Japan, with this limited immigration, there are very few people willing to do the work. So they still have delivery challenges, but at least they've come a ways towards fixing the financing problems.
That's a fascinating story, and I'm really particularly interested in it because my wife is half Korean, and in the Asian society, there is they are less sort of open to outsiders assisting with the care. It's sort of considered a family obligation. So I think that's really interesting that in Japan there was a lot of pressure to sort of change that system and help get some help to the family caregivers.
It's really interesting. In some countries around the world, it is actually against the law. In India, for example, it's against the law to not care for your parents.
Really? Wow.
You're committing a crime if you don't care for your elderly parents. These cultural issues are actually very interesting, and it's kind of fun to look at them. But imagine a law like that in the United States.
No, I don't think that would go very far. Staying on the caregiver topic, you were a long-distance caregiver, and I almost was one. I actually decided I was living on the West Coast when my father was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and that was one of the reasons I moved back. I also got a job offer to come back home to the East Coast. But that creates a really unique set of challenges. And could you talk a little bit about how the difficulties of caring for someone who either are hundreds or thousands of miles away?
Yeah, and you know, John, it almost doesn't matter whether it's hundreds of miles or thousands of miles away. When you're in a different city, you have this entire extra set of stresses. You know, I remember what I was doing with my dad. He was living in Florida, and my mom was still alive, so she was really his primary caregiver, but I was trying to help. Every Friday, I would get on the plane, or every other Friday, I would get on the plane and I'd fly to Florida, spend the weekend. And, you know, it was interesting because at the beginning, what I was really trying to do was fix things. I'd come down to Florida and, you know, talk to the doctor and talk to the home health agency and try to kind of arrange all these things. And I finally figured out that really wasn't what I was supposed to be doing, that my real role was to just spend some time sitting with my dad and talking with him, giving my mother a little bit of a break so she could just get out of the house a little. But the pressure was tremendous. I mean, I remember trying to work. I was working at Business Week at the time, and you know, trying to do my job. And you know, every day there'd be another phone call and another crisis. And you know, trying to deal with all that from a distance is just a huge, huge challenge. This gets even more complicated when you've got siblings who are in different cities, and you know, you've got one sibling who may be in the same city as the parent, but others who are in other cities who are trying to kind of deal with their guilt and trying to deal with the relationships with their siblings all at the same time, and it's just a huge, huge challenge. Our mutual friend Gene Levin always talks about the swoopers, who are the adult children who live in some other city who come in and start second guessing what their sibling who's living in the same city with their parent is doing. So it's very complicated. It's really hard, and it's also very expensive. It turns out there's some research out there that shows that distance caregivers spend two or three times as much as local caregivers do, and some of that is simply their transportation. Some of it is hiring more assistants that you might not have to do if you were in the same city. So it's a real challenge.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We are getting close to running up against our time, so I do want to ask you one more question, because you talk about this in your book, and I think it kind of goes into the whole discussion we've been having about caregiving and caring from a distance. So what do you think the future, what is the future of aging in place? What do you see that being?
You know, it has become the mantra of many of the advocacy groups that we should all age in place. My view of this is, first of all, we should recognize that there are some of us who will not be able to age in place. We're not going to have the infrastructure. We're going to have diseases, for example, advanced dementia, that make it very difficult to stay at home. But for those people who do age in place, I think the most important thing to think about is that this requires a much bigger infrastructure than you might normally think about. Normally you think about, well, so what do I need to age in place? I need to make sure that there's an aide who can help me out when I need the assistance. It takes a lot more than that. It requires transportation. It requires food. It requires a safe place to live. And I think both local governments and communities have to begin to think about ways that we can begin to provide that infrastructure in maybe some non-traditional methods. One of the things I love are the idea of senior villages, where seniors living in a neighborhood can all get together and help one another out as they age. In some ways, we're talking about this distance issue. In some ways, you know, we have to find substitutes for traditional families, which of course, in many cases, don't really exist anymore. So I think, you know, aging in place is something that we can all aspire to. I think it's something that is doable, but it requires a lot more support, a lot more infrastructure than we currently have, and we need to give a lot more thought to how we're going to provide it, because it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to come from the government, not with the financial constraints government's under.
No, I completely agree. And one of the things I'm very glad you raised is the fact that while I think we all want to age in place and it works for most people, there are safety considerations that come into play, particularly with people with advanced dementia. And I know two people. One is my sister's father-in-law, and another is actually someone who works with us on eCare Diary who have parents with advanced dementia and are having safety issues right now, and it would not be safe. They're in facilities that specialize in caring for people with advanced dementia, but they would not be safe at home.
That's right. That's right. I mean, they're a danger to themselves, or a danger to other people. You just have to recognize that sometimes, despite all of our best intentions, the best place for people may be some sort of institutional care. Now, that doesn't mean we can't also aspire to having much better institutional care. You know, the greenhouses and the culture change movement and all the rest of it are very important to provide skilled nursing facilities that can do this kind of work. But absolutely, I mean, you just can't say that for everybody in every case, staying at home is the best solution, because it just isn't.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Howard, thank you so much for being a guest. It's been a pleasure speaking about these things, and you're so knowledgeable and bring a great perspective on this.
It's always great to talk to you, John.
And I also want to tell our audience, you can learn more about Howard on www.howardgleckman.com. That's howardgleckman.com. And you can also learn about how to get his book, Caring for Our Parents, there as well. And I'd like to thank our audience for tuning in. Join us next Monday, November 1st at 2 p.m. Eastern, when co-founder Susan Bida will interview Dr. John Birchler, a co-author of Elder Mediation, A New Solution to Old Age Problems, and co-owner of North Coast Conflict Solutions. To learn more about eCare Diary and our upcoming shows, visit www.ecarediary.com. That's ecarediary.com. Registration is free and gives you immediate access to your personal care diary tool. You can also find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. My Twitter address is eCareDiaryJohn. Thank you again for listening, and tune in next week.